I'd like to call to order today's hearing, Committee on Public Safety Policy and Finance, today, March 22, 2006. Clerk, take the roll.
Chairman Smith.
Here.
Representative Eastland.
Here.
Cornish. Ellison.
Here.
Hillstrom.
Here.
Johnson.
Here.
Nestle. Murphy.
Here.
Nelson.
Here.
Newman.
Here.
Kamar.
Here.
Bobstrom.
Here.
We never have to worry about a quorum. Church, the chairman knows that, notices that we do have a quorum. So let us first take up the consideration of the minutes from March 21, 2006. They are in the packet. Is there a motion on those minutes?
So moved.
Representative Johnson moves approval. Any questions or discussion? Seeing none, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed,
aye.
No. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. First item on the agenda will be House File 1014, Representative Clark. Committee, what we're going to attempt to do on these bills is present them by the author. The although we have witnesses listed, they will be here not to present but to answer any questions the committee may have. If there are no questions, then it's my intent to proceed with that bill, either laying it over on laying it on the table for possible inclusion, or if there is a particular action that needs to be taken, a motion will follow. So we will attempt to move through these bills with full understanding of the contents, presentation briefly by the author, and then if there's no questions, we'll so act. Representative Clark, if you're here, you may take the table. Now, we have had testimony on this bill before. There is an amendment in the packet. You have presented the amendment. It's the chair's thinking that the bill has been thoroughly presented as well as the amendment. We now have both items in the possession of the committee, so the chair will move the amendments. We'll take the bill off the table, and it's before the the chair will move House File 1014 to get it before the committee. The chair will also move Amendment H1014DE1, and let's deal with the amendment now. Are there any questions on the amendment? If not, the chair moves the amendment to get the bill in the author's desired shape on the amendment. Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 1014 has amended. The chair would move the bill, offer a motion to move, recommend the bill, and that it be re-referred to the Committee on Health Policy and Finance. Representative Clark, I trust that's acceptable.
It sure is, Mr. Chair. Thank you. We had extensive testimony on the amendment as the bill last time I was here.
Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
House File 3312, Representative Holberg. You've come to the table. Federal conformity on commercial driver's license revocation. The chair moves the bill to get it before the committee, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. There is a A061263 amendment that I'd like to have the committee approve to get the bill in the shape that we'd like to discuss it today. And it deletes the first section of the bill, which was trying to address an issue about if somebody that had a commercial driver's license and when they tested at 0.4 above and when their license would be suspended, and we're not sure we have the language right on this, but at this point we just want to delete section one of the bill and then line three of the amendment is more technical in nature.
Chair moves the amendment to get the bill in the shape the author wants. Any discussion on that motion, on the motion to amend? Those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those
aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 3312, as amended, is before the committee. Any questions? Discussion? my intent then to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative, thank you. Do you have any other business this morning before us? I don't think so. Next item is House File 3433, Johnson, Representative Johnson J., Federal Background Checks of Executive Branch Managers.
Mr. Chairman, I move House File 3433 be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right. Tell us about your bill, Representative.
Mr. Chairman, it's pretty simple. The bill simply authorizes the governor's office to conduct background checks on candidates within the governor's residence or by appointment by the governor. For some reason, the governor's not allowed to do that right now, and this would allow it.
Any questions?
None that I know of, President.
All right. Anyone present wanting to be heard on this bill, raise your hand. I see no one. All right, it's before the committee. On that motion, Chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
House File 3313, Representative Newman, Procedures on Revocation of Licenses for Fireworks Operators. Want to move your bill, Representative Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move House File 3413 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Newman, perhaps this you should revise your motion that it be recommended to pass and that it be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Elections. They've requested hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was not aware of that. And I would move that this matter be passed out of this committee and re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law.
Okay. Would you briefly describe your bill?
Very briefly, Your Honor, this is an agency bill.
Representative Newman, not yet.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I missed something.
You're not in court. You're in committee. Well, we will not rule on any objections to
my sincere apologies, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
This is an agency bill which provides for an appeal process in the event an entity dealing with fireworks disagrees with the decision of a fire marshal, and was recommended to the State Fire Marshal's Office pursuant to an Attorney General's notification that this was needed. And I've got with me the State Fire Marshal, Jerry Rosendahl, if you've got any questions, but it seems to me pretty straightforward. It's strictly fixing up an existing law to provide for an appeal of a decision by the State Fire Marshal.
Mr. Rosendahl, welcome. Are there any questions from the committee? Is there anyone present in this room wanting to be heard on this bill? Raise your hand. I see no one. All right, then, let's go back to discussion by the committee. Take up your motion that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Any further discussion? If not, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Eastland, House File 3338, Annual Testing of Inmates for Tuberculosis.
My assumption is House File 3338 will be laid over. Is that the plan?
For
possible inclusion.
You can move the bill, and then it will be held over.
Okay. I'll move House File 3338 before the committee and be laid over for future consideration.
Tell us about your bill.
The House File 3338 is just I guess I would call it a technical issue. Currently, statute requires the corrections to do tuberculosis testing for all inmates on a regular basis, but there is nothing in the law that allows the commissioner to require that to occur if an inmate refuses. So basically what we're doing is that we're just adding a little section that says if the inmate does refuse to submit to the test, that the commissioner has the right to order the test to be done.
All Any questions from the committee? Anyone present in the room wanting to be heard on this bill, raise your hand. I see no one. All right, any additional discussion? If not, the chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Eastland. We'll move on to your next item. House File 3565, medical decisions may be made by DOC medical director.
Okay, I will move also that 3565 be brought before us and be held over for possible inclusion.
Okay, go ahead.
This bill is dealing with an issue that's becoming more critical in our prisons with an aging population. But before we talk about the bill, I have an amendment I'd like to have put on it. So it's A1 amendment.
What does that do?
Basically, it just requires the department to notify next of kin before there's any change in the status of who can make medical decisions for the...
Representative Eastland moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? If not, on the amendment, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Then on the bill as amended.
Okay, what this bill does is it clarifies a process for the corrections to be able to identify who can make medical decisions for an inmate in the case that they're incapacitated. Currently what happens is the inmates can request and can identify the person that will make those kinds of decisions. Oftentimes they refuse, and then when they are incapacitated, the corrections has to just kind of operate in a gray zone and make those decisions without any authorization. And so what this bill does, it creates a process that the corrections needs to go through, and when they've done their due diligence, then they have the right to make those decisions in for the inmate.
Questions from the committee? Any? All right.
You want to ask a question? You want to ask a question?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, under next kin, by the amendment, what about their partner?
Not my amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Murphy. Representative Eastland.
What I asked to have done when they drafted this amendment was to look at who currently legally has the authority to make these decisions in law. The inmate can request a person to make those decisions for them. This would only be used if an inmate is incapacitated and they have not made that request. So if somebody has a partner that they would like to make those decisions, that would be who they would request. If you have somebody else in your life that you would like to make those decisions other than the next of kin, that's who you would request. But in the event that the inmate is incapacitated or at the point where they no longer can make those decisions and they have not designated that person, then this is the protocol that we already have kind of in law that they need to do, to notify the next of kin.
Thank you for that clarification.
You're welcome. Any other questions from the committee? If not, on the House File 3565, Representative Eastland, the chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have Representative Seibert or Lanning in the audience? Well, Representative Meslow. House File 3357, going out of order. Revision on DNA expungement procedures. Representative Murphy, Representative Meslow, a motion would be in order to recommend to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Civil Law. They've requested it.
Okay, that's fine then, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House File 3357 actually restores some language that we passed out of committee as a part of our omnibus bill last year. It was amended on the floor to the current language that... The way we passed it out of committee, if a person is found
not guilty of a charge or a case is dismissed, that the that individual then has the right to petition to have the DNA, their DNA sample destroyed or returned to them. The amendment on the floor no longer required someone to petition to have that DNA sample returned or destroyed. Rather, it said that that automatically would be done by the BCA. That has created some bureaucratic or logistical problems for the BCA, and so that's why House File 3357 restores the language that initially came out of the committee in our omnibus bill. I have with me James Iverson from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to address the logistical problems that they've had implementing the existing law.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Meslow, I know your testifier is going to describe the problem, but could you sort of give us a little bit of background history as to how the problem started cropping up and how you became aware that simply dispensing with those dismissed DNA samples of samples of dismissed cases was a problem? What's sort of the back genesis of this?
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, this was presented to me by the agency, and so the impetus came from there. I can pretty well presume that just looking at the logistics of what happens with the criminal cases, when a case is dismissed or a defendant is found not guilty, certainly the prosecutor is aware of that. It's generally fairly straightforward that law enforcement finds out about it, but it does become a little bit more problematic for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to realize that in fact is what's occurred in those cases, and so it then becomes a matter of how do they monitor and stay on top of that. I know that Mr. Iverson will have more detail than that, but I can just envision how that problem would occur. Mr. Chair, would you like Mr. Iverson to elaborate on that, or would you like to
he can briefly elaborate on that, please.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, my name is Jim Iverson. I'm a supervisor for the BCA lab in charge of the DNA databasing operations that we have currently ongoing. The problem that we've had with the language, as it's stated, is that we have had to redirect staff resources to consistently look at criminal histories over and over again until the cases are resolved, so to see if an acquittal has occurred. Right now, with the language, if the case is dismissed, it's up to the individual to request the removal of the sample, but if there's an acquittal, we have to do it proactively. So that's the issue. We've had to redirect staff resources to continually monitor criminal histories.
Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, and I identify with that problem. That sounds like it would be sort of a administrative problem. But, I mean, our nation is based on the idea that if you are found not guilty, that you should not have to carry the stain of a criminal conviction, particularly not from the standpoint of the government. Of course, citizens will presume whatever they want about your acquittal, but I just say I think that as important as the thing you're talking about is, when you weigh that against a citizen having been charged with a crime and a jury of their peers, 12 people having found that they are not guilty, and they still have to go through changes to get that DNA back, I just think that even though your consideration is very important, and I don't want to diminish it at all because it is important, and resources are precious, that the merits have to weigh in favor of that person who's found not guilty. And therefore, I'm thinking that is there a way to work with the BCA and the courts so that you only have to check one time, so that it would somehow the courts could send the information just in the form of an email even, that, you know, so-and-so has been found not guilty. I mean, I just wonder if this is a middle ground rather than forcing the burden back on the acquitted person. Is there a way to just get word to the BCA in a more expeditious, easier way? Because I don't want to waste BCA resources, and I think you're right to bring the issue forward, but the merits, to me, weigh heavily on the other side. So is there a way?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I can tell you we've worked very closely with the prosecutor's offices, with law enforcement. We have found that it's very difficult. We almost have to come up with an individual plan for each agency to try and do that, and that's been a very difficult task. And I'm not sure that we could create 100% coverage by doing that. It's been very difficult with the systems that each prosecutor's office has available to come up with something that would guarantee consistency among all agencies.
Representative Ellison. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, so for example, if we included a piece in the law that said that at the end of the disposition of a case, there should be an email forwarded to the BCA that the case was acquitted, would that do it, just like a statewide blanket rule? We're talking about something pretty quick, painless.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ellison, I can't tell you that it would be 100% effective. We're simply addressing the law that's in front of us. Is that a method that might work if possible?
Okay. Members, I need to try to accommodate some members who have other committee action. I'm going to suspend this one, lay it over briefly, and ask Representative Lanning to take a seat, see if we can get him back to Tax Committee. Sorry, gentlemen.
Certainly, Mr.
Representative Lanning. House File 3336, ban on alcohol without liquid, AWOL devices. Would you please sit down and tell us what this bill does? Chair will move the bill. It's before the committee. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, members. House File 3336 prohibits a new device that is just now being marketed in our country. And, Mr. Chairman, we have an amendment that adds a penalty clause. We'd like to ask that the A1 amendment be added to the bill.
The chair, I'll move the A1 amendment. Would you describe that a little more fully, what that amendment does, Representative Lanning?
The amendment provides for this to be a violation of this law to be a misdemeanor. And for those that are under 21, it would be no less than a $100 fine. And that's already in statute.
Let's deal with the amendment. Any discussion on that amendment? If not, on the amendment, Representative Murphy.
I don't understand how you picked the no less than $100 and why you picked no less than $100, the reason for it.
Representative Lanning, there's a roll call in your other committee. Leave your witnesses to answer your questions. If that doesn't thoroughly answer the question of a member of this committee,
When
you get back here, you can retake up the question. So
Thank
I expect you back here as soon as you're called.
Thank you very much.
I'm sorry, Representative Murphy. Please restate.
What was the need for the... If they're less than 21 years of age, the fine would be no less than $100. How was that picked and why?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, my name is Marlene Schultzberg. I am a supervisor with the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. In answer to your question, the $100 is consistent with another section of Chapter 348 that also refers to the $100 penalty, no less than the minimum $100. And that's all I have. Regarding information.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Schultzberg, if you're over 21, could the fine be less than $100?
Representative Murphy, are you referring to a licensee? Are you referring to just an ordinary person?
Well, I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Schultzberg, because I haven't heard the bill, but I expect an ordinary person.
An ordinary person could be subject to up to a $3,000 penalty, I believe.
But less than $100?
Representative Murphy, I'm not sure on that.
Representative Murphy, I'm going to go to Ms. Pirius. She can help us.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think there's been a misunderstanding. In statute, it says when no other penalty is provided under this chapter, it's a misdemeanor. And there's a minimum $100 fine, but that applies to a different section. So that $100 fine doesn't apply here. It would be a misdemeanor, which would be a minimum of 90 days in jail or a $1,000 fine.
Is that a verb?
I'm sorry, maximum.
Maximum. But not less than.
It could be less than. Okay. The max is a $1,000 fine.
The author's returning to the table. Any additional questions, Representative Haymar?
I don't understand what the bill is about.
Well, actually, procedurally, Representative Haymar, we're on the amendment. So I'm going to call a vote on the amendment, then we can get into the bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Lanning.
The amendment, to Representative Murphy's question, that's existing law. That penalty provision. When minors are in possession of alcohol as minors, the existing law says no less than $100 fine. So we're not changing anything with existing law.
Let's deal with the amendment, and before we go any further with the bill. On the amendment, any further discussion? Those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. We are now back on the House File 3336. Representative Lanning, we don't need an actual real live demonstration of the unit, but is that
okay.
It sitting there?
That's it.
Can you go through a fake demonstration?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members, I'd like to introduce Paul Kaspar from the Minnesota Municipal Beverage Association. He could just make a comment or two about the device.
What does it do? Identify yourself and tell us what does it do and what can people do to themselves with it or with themselves.
Mr. Chair, my name is Paul Kaspar. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Municipal Beverage Association, and we represent cities with municipal liquor stores in the state. This is the machine. Basically, I bought this one on eBay. It was, because I'm kind of cheap, it was $30 cheaper than buying it directly from the a place called AWOL USA, whose purpose is to sell this. For your information, you could go to AWOLUSA.com and purchase the machine. Like I said, mine was cheaper on eBay. It was very easy to get. It ran about $260, give or take, and showed up UPS. This is a single-unit machine. They do make commercial units. Basically, what you do is you take this is vodka, and pour a little bit of the vodka in there. I put it in, turn the machine on, and vapors come out here. So it takes the alcohol and vaporizes it. So what you do is grab on and suck it in. So again, they market it. What they're trying to say is that it doesn't. There's less calories and no carbohydrates and a lot of those other types of things. But what happens is, and Marlene can get more into it, it bypasses all the natural processes of the way alcohol is absorbed into the body. Once you drink, it goes into your stomach. Depending on what you eat, the pyloric valve is closed and the absorption rate is different and so forth. But basically, this goes and bypasses that whole process and goes directly into your bloodstream. They say it lasts about 15 to 20 minutes, which is, but we've had, to be honest, Mr. Chair and members, none of us have wanted to try it, but we did have one of our cohorts try it at a trade show. And he lasted 5 minutes before he got a splitting headache. So, in a nutshell, that's That's what it is.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could get a page to distribute a handout. This handout that we're distributing indicates that 12 states already have banned this device. Another 18 states, including Minnesota, are considering a ban, and so this is not something that only we're looking at here in the state of Minnesota. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to call on Marlene Schelsberg from the Department of Public Safety. She's in charge of alcohol and gambling enforcement for the department. Make some comments about this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have just a less than 5 minute presentation regarding these alcohol without liquid devices.
Well, before you do that, Representative Hillstrom, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I do, and maybe she's going to address it. I guess I was just curious as to what the effects of doing this is and why it's bad, and because ultimately if it has a more severe consequence, or you know, people are more at risk of death or whatever, I guess I'm trying to just get at the essence of why it's bad for people to use that for intoxication versus drinking the alcohol.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I will get into that in my presentation that I have here. A British entrepreneur, Dominique Semler, has created a device that allows users to inhale vaporized alcohol along with oxygen, a machine he calls Alcohol Without Liquid, or AWOL. Spirit Partners Incorporated of New York acquired the exclusive license to market the AWOL technology in the United States. The machine, which has been available on the East Coast since the summer of 2004, takes hard liquor and disperses it as a vapor in an oxygen mist. The cost of the commercial unit, which resembles an inhaler, is about $3,000, while home-style units can be ordered online for $299. The AWOL machine is marketed as the ultimate party tool with promises of hangover-free and calorie-free consumption. There are many factors that contribute to hangovers, however, such as dehydration and the disruption of electrolyte balances, which are caused by ingestion or inhalation of ethanol. Additionally, relating to calories, as the body metabolizes alcohol, whether through the stomach or through inhalation, the calories are the same. Alcohol vapor ingested from an AWOL device bypasses the stomach and the filtering capabilities of the liver and is absorbed through the blood vessels in the nose or lungs, creating a faster and more intense high or intoxicating effect on the brain. Inhalation of alcohol may be more likely to cause alcohol toxicity than binge drinking because the user does not have time to feel the effects as it enters the bloodstream and is not subject to the protective effects of the digestive system. Alcohol is a solvent, and breathing solvents can cause brain and nasal passage damage. Research scientists have exposed experimental rats to air mixed with vaporized alcohol. This method is used because the desired dependence is achieved extremely efficiently, sometimes in a matter of days. Manufacturers of the alcohol without liquid device warn users to inhale no more than 2 shots during a 24-hour period. However, there are public safety concerns that individuals, especially underage persons, could alter the machine's design to diffuse the alcohol more quickly or inhale 190-proof Everclear grain alcohol instead of the recommended 80-proof spirit, or not follow the manufacturer's advice of no more than 2 shots during a 24-hour period. Additionally, I could find no research regarding the use of alcohol without liquid devices and the results of breathalyzer tests. This product has not been tested on humans, and there is not, to my knowledge, no known studies for measuring blood alcohol levels for inhalation of alcohol as there is for ingestion of alcohol. 12 states have already passed laws to ban these devices, and several more states have legislation pending. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we can buy these machines on eBay, and the state has a law, if this bill passes, in opposition to buying, or that disallows people to buy the machine, but they can still get them on eBay, or they can get them through the internet.
then does the person that sends for the machine and pays $2.95 for it pay the fine then, or does, how do you go after them? How do you go after the individual that buys it for $2.95 on the internet?
Ms. Shelberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the individual person, not a licensee, would be subject to the criminal penalties that we discussed previously, the minimum of the $100 fine, and it would be done through, in, like an ordinary criminal proceeding. Local law enforcement would find these people that were possessing these devices.
After they have them.
After they have them.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Patsick, is it just that you represent the municipal stores, or does this have a special liability to the municipal stores?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no. Part of our mission is to control the sale of alcohol in our communities. And controlling the sale of alcohol means more than just responsible service. Responsible service means don't sell to anybody who's underage, don't sell to anybody who's intoxicated. Control means reflecting a community attitude and not doing things that are necessarily legal. And so this falls into our mission of doing so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lanny, you feel that this is a serious threat to the public safety of the citizens of Minnesota and the youth of Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, absolutely. That's why I'm bringing forward the bill. We have a national epidemic of binge drinking. And the reason you're seeing a dozen states already enacting this, another 18 considering it, is that that concern is across the country. And some of the worst binge drinking statistics come from the upper Midwest. My community in the last year or so has experienced two tragic deaths as a result of binge drinking. And we had a symposium in our community last December where we brought together law enforcement, educators, a broad cross-section of citizens who are very concerned about this issue in our community, our area. And we're, in fact, having a town meeting this coming week. There's a tremendous amount of concern. I think the feeling is that if this device becomes readily available and if it becomes widely used, that we're going to greatly increase the amount of binge drinking that takes place in our communities and our country. And having worked with young people in education for nearly 39 years, I can readily envision that this device is going to have an appeal where you set it up, and how can law enforcement, when you have a device like this, how can law enforcement really determine who all is using it? You know, I suppose they can do breathalyzer. We don't know exactly how this might affect breathalyzers. So I'm very concerned about binge drinking, and I think this device being readily available and widely used is really going to create more problems with that serious issue.
Representative Hilston, did you have additional questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Lanning, or the expert, could a regular child nebulizer do the same exact thing as this particular item, or maybe a, you know, a Vicks steamer that you put alcohol instead of the Vicks in instead? Would that have the same effect, and then would that also be a problem with this law as well?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes to the first part. No to the second part, the part about the, it went in the steamer part. You have to, it's kind of a, I think, and I'm not a total expert, I just kind of went to the drugstore and looked around. This is more of a concentrated type of a thing where the steamer you kind of mix with water and it's kind of a thing, but a child nebulizer, yes.
Would that fall under this law then as well? In the event that someone took an old child nebulizer and used it for the same purpose, would that fall under this as well?
My understanding would be if they used it for that purpose, yes. But if someone is using the device for medical reasons or the exemptions that are noted in the bill, no. I mean, it's not saying the bill that you have before you exempts legitimate use of this device. What it addresses is using the device for the consumption of alcohol. That's what is not allowed.
Before we go any further, I just want to alert the committee. We have a visiting tour here today of some high school students from El Colegio Charter School in Minneapolis. Welcome to you, students. Any further questions on this bill? Representative Lanning, I don't see any. Chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you. Representative Seibert, House File 3521, Exhibition Racing, if you'd have a seat at the table. Chair will move the bill to get it before the committee. My intent to lay it over afterwards for possible inclusion. Tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This bill kind of expands the definition of reckless driving to include exhibition driving. I put in a bill last year that would make drag racing illegal and included the drag racer, the organizers of the events, and also spectators. That was a little too stringent, and so department bill came out, and this is a department bill right away that kind of mirrored that, but took some of those restrictions out. What this does is makes exhibition driving or reckless driving, drag racing is included in that definition, and it also defines exhibition driving to where any start acceleration, unnecessary acceleration, exhibition of speed would be a petty misdemeanor. We did have that as a misdemeanor. We knocked it down to a petty misdemeanor simply for Representative Earhart, who likes to school with fires leaving the parking ramp. So,
Representative Seibert, I think there was a bill last year, I don't know if it was this one, that had penalized spectators. This does not do that. Is that correct?
No, sir. That bill was my bill last year, and we took, actually, I just used the language that the department wanted, and this is from the State Patrol.
Very good.
And it is a lot more reasonable.
Seems to be. Questions? Any questions from the committee? Anyone in the audience wanting to be heard on this bill, please raise your hand now. About ready to wave the checkered flag on this bill. Anyone with questions? All right. Okay. Representative Tamar.
But just to play devil's advocate here, Mr. Chair.
Any bills not concluded on this morning's calendar, we will take up Monday evening at 5:30. As part of County of St. Louis and City of Duluth days, we will be here at 5:30. Just kidding, Representative Paymark. Go ahead.
You know Representative Paymark's roots.
That's right. I'm originally a Duluthian. Representative Seibert, I'm just trying to... Could law enforcement or could an individual inadvertently violate this law? I mean, I think... You know, it would be fairly easy to throw sand or gravel coming on from a dirt road onto a paved road. I'm sure our law enforcement isn't sitting around waiting for cars to do such a thing, but that, I mean, I'm just wondering if someone could inadvertently get caught up in this under lines 22 and 23 of the bill.
Representative Seibert.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kamar, in any law you could inadvertently get caught up in that. And the reason we brought that down to a petty misdemeanor is just because of that. Law enforcement exercises a certain amount of discretion that they could see. And when the reason I knocked this down to a petty misdemeanor was, I mean, all of us leave the parking ramp going, if we go left on Rice Street leaving, sometimes you got to punch it to get across there before the traffic hits, you know. That would be inadvertently.
You're not supposed to turn left between 4 and 6, you know that.
What I meant to say was, not that I've ever done that, but this would be unnecessary, and that would be up to the judgment of the policeman that would be enforcing this.
Representative Hilston. Any questions? I'm sorry, Eastland. I can't read.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Seibert, maybe you just answered my question, but this in Section 2A, the prima facie evidence of unnecessary exhibition of speed, how is that just a determination of the officer? Is that the automatic condition that finds somebody guilty of this, or what is the...
Representative Seibert.
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, I haven't been in law enforcement for 10 years, so I'm going to go refer to Major Al Smith of the State Patrol and let him answer that.
Sure, and give us your name.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Representative. I'm Al Smith. I'm a major with the Minnesota State Patrol. In response to your question, as Representative Siebert said earlier, a lot of it falls within the discretion of the officers across the state, whether it's at the State Patrol, the county sheriff's deputies, or the local officers that interpret this. This language is out there and exists in many cities across the state right now, so it's not new language that's being used. The officers out there right now, including the troopers that have come across this within those city jurisdictions, have used this language. We're just trying to bring it out to the state trunk highways and the areas outside the cities where this racing problem, this exhibition problem, is now moving because of the cities taking such an aggressive stance on it, and they're moving that problem.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you. If somebody wanted to contest the charge, how would that process work?
Under the petty misdemeanor statute, they have the right to come in before a judge or a hearing officer or a referee, depending where you're at in the state, and they're able to contest that charge before that person. The officer would have to give her or his or her testimony in relation to what took place. The defendant that was charged in this would also have the ability to give their version of the story to that hearing officer, so there'd be a neutral third party.
Any other questions from the committee? Anyone wanting to be heard on this bill, raise your hand. I see nobody. Very good. Representative Seibert, thank you. Chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Representative Meslow, let's return to you.
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
House File 3357. I'm sure you remember where we were at, if you'd care to have a seat at the table. I believe we have, in the order that I think we have them, Representatives Ellison, Murphy, and Hillsborough. Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair. Representative Meslow.
And you.
What if your bill were altered to place the burden on the court to send the information to the BCA? The court is the place that the defendant, who has just been found not guilty, is standing. That person is right there in front of them. The court does have the responsibility to enter data into, their system. One more email to the BCA, I can't imagine that would be too tough. They're going to enter information regarding acquittal anyway in their record-keeping system. Would that be an accommodation you could seriously entertain?
Representative Maslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I think certainly it is less burdensome on the courts to do that kind of notification than it would be for the BCA to simply to monitor the volume of cases. The one thing we have to be prepared to live with is that because there are, I would estimate, 40 or 50 courthouses around the state of Minnesota, there's going to be some slippage. When we, if the burden is on the BCA, we have one entity, and their accuracy is going to, I expect, be very high in destroying those samples. When we've got as many courthouses as we do around the state, mistakes are going to be made in places, and we're not going to see them coming, and we have to be prepared to live with those mistakes. But I would certainly agree that it's a less burdensome alternative.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellis.
So, because my thought is that, you have several thousand cases that are charged. Only about 10% of the cases charged actually go to trial, and I would say that maybe I don't know, 30% of those that result in acquittals. I don't know what the numbers are. In my case, maybe 100%. But
I was just going to say, Mr. Ellison, Representative Ellison, that you're taking a higher percentage of cases to trial than most of the attorneys I see, and you apparently are winning far more of them than most of the defense attorneys I see. But that's certainly a testament to your skills in the other arena.
Oh, I'm so glad you noticed that. but Mr. Chair, so I just so hope we can sort of see if would you be willing to sort of like discuss that with me as the bill moves along.
The bill will be going from here, assuming this moves to civil law, and then we will have the opportunity to take any amendments that they attach, plus there will be time for you and others to work with Representative Mesler by the time we get back to considering this bill.
And, Mr. Chair, that would, in fact, be my intention. I would also like to bring Representative Ellison's suggestion to Sue DeSalle from the courts and talk about the logistics from those ends and see if she feels that that would be a good logistical solution as well.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Iverson, I'm interested in your in what you said about using BCA resources and your accounting techniques. That what statistics do you have for us of how many hours of BCA resources were used or how many cases were reviewed and how many DNAs were returned since this bill has passed and since this bill became so onerous?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, since the law went into effect on July 1st of 2005, we have received to date, I haven't checked in a couple weeks, but over 2,000 samples taken as a result of the statute. There has been a learning curve as law enforcement has become aware of the statute. So we anticipate that that number should rise. We took an arbitrary time frame of 6 months. So when we received the sample on July 1st, we took January 1st as the date that we would first check those criminal histories. We assumed it would take a few months for that case to work its way through the law or through the correction system or the legal system. We then checked those samples on a monthly basis, so it's recurring as the samples or as the cases work their way through the system. So you can see there's sort of an additional effect because every month you're not only checking those cases that weren't resolved the previous month, you're now checking a whole new group of samples that have reached the 6 months. And you can see it kind of adds on to itself as the cases have to work their way through. So it's kind of it feeds on itself, if you will. Every month there's more and more samples to look at. Does that answer your question?
Well, Mr. Chair, more anecdotal than statistical, though. Is there any kind of numerical cost that this has cost you? The cost of BCA, and have you used or have you received additional resources for that purpose?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, we estimate that it's taking approximately 40% of the time of the two criminal intelligence analysts that were hired as a result of funding that we received for the passage of this legislation last year. However, we did not request at the time funding to do this because that was not in the language when we were asked to offer our fiscal note. So these two individuals are spending a good deal of their time tracking these samples.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Iverson, what would they be doing with the 40% of their time if they weren't checking the tracking?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, their specific job duties are to receive the samples, to evaluate the samples, to enter them into all of the information into a computerized system so that we can track them. Their basic functions are to receive the samples and put them into this database. They are not being as efficient in doing that because of the time that they're being forced to spend to comply with the statute.
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Meslow, I think maybe while you're exploring what Representative Ellison suggested, I remember supporting this very strongly, the change in the language so that the DNA would be returned to the person that was found innocent or not guilty. And I think that's a pretty high principle. And maybe we should be talking about an additional amount of money to give the BCA the adequate resources. But I think I would like a little more detail on the cost with a monetary sum of money on the cost before I would say, yes, we should do that. But that's another way to think about it rather than not go back to the original language. I think returning is still a good goal, and if we can find a way to do that. And maybe we don't need the criminal intelligence person with the CI person doing that. Maybe someone else could be doing the checking of the record at a lower level of pay. But, Mr. Chair, I've always been for jobs, jobs, jobs.
Massel, Representative Massel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it's interesting because the dialogue we've been having is exactly the discussion that was occurring while other bills were being heard. We were having these very conversations informally. The general sense is that this has been an unfunded mandate, probably in the neighborhood of $70,000-$75,000 a year. And it's interesting, in committee, Representative Ellison is talking about removing the mandate. You're talking about providing the funding, and I think those are exactly the questions that we should be looking at and the kinds of things that I would like us to be looking at as a committee after we've brought this back from civil law.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Meslow, I was just speaking with Representative Ellison about even potentially at the court time, if the person could be given the information or a piece of paper to sign, so that could, you know, just be part of the process. Again, I don't know what process you're proposing that they have to go to the BCA to get that done, but I think if the process was easy or near automatic, you would have less objection to proceeding with that.
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, thank you. Very thoughtful.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Meslow, I find myself in agreement with Representative Ellison on this matter. I, too, remember this provision from last year, and I think it's an appropriate responsibility of the state as opposed to an acquitted defendant. So I would encourage you to continue to work on this. It would seem to me that we should be able to find a way to handle this from an administrative standpoint. That's what we're really talking about. I don't think there's a whole lot of disagreement with destroying or returning the sample. I just wanted you to know what my thoughts were on that matter.
Any other questions? If not, we'll go back to the motion that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law and Elections. Any discussion? If not, those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Meslow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Representative Murphy, I think you're up next.
Oh.
House File 3412.
My re-election bill.
Good. Variance in fire code procedures. Would you care to make a motion? Then I think we have an amendment also.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. House File 3412 is an agency bill, and I move that it be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
All right, the bill is before us then.
And Mr. Chair, I move Amendment 123, adoption of Amendment 1233, which is a housekeeping. The bill is a housekeeping bill, which allows people to appeal directly to the fire marshal.
for a variance.
On the amendment.
And the amendment is like a delete everything.
Okay. Questions? Anyone
in the audience? Mr. Rosenthal, Fire Marshal, is here to answer any questions.
Any questions? Anyone in the audience wishing to be heard on this bill, please raise your hand at this time. No one has. No further testimony and no questions that I can see.
Move adoption of the amendment.
That amendment, that motion, I should say, is before us. On that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed to no. That motion prevails. If there's no other questions, the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy, if that was a re-election bill, how come you didn't have a cameraman in here like so many others have?
I don't know what happened to him.
All right, Representative, who's next? Nelson M., House File 3532, revision of 9-11 provisions.
And I'm not going to claim this to be my re-election bill. 3532, just a brief description of it. You have
The record should reflect Representative Nelson moves the bill.
For possible inclusion?
Correct. And now go ahead.
You have the overview from House Research. Basically what this is, a department bill. It consolidates two separate statutes to deal with the 9/11 calls and the charges for those. It streamlines the certification process, modernizes the business practices for the department, and eliminates obsolete language. And it's been supported by the telephone companies and all the people, the counties and everybody involved in it. And it's just a simple housekeeping bill. And I'll stand for any questions. I have Ron Whitehead here from the department, and he can answer any questions about the technicalities of the bill.
Very good. Are there any questions at this point from the committee? Is there anyone in the audience who wants to be heard on this bill? Please raise your hand at this time. There is nobody here. Any questions from the committee? I see none. Representative Nelson, thank you and your witness. Chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Representative Nelson, I think you should remain at the table. House File 3529, Repeal Obsolete Language, Metropolitan Radio Board.
And I move for possible inclusion and the omnibus bill.
Okay. Bill is before us. Go ahead.
Again, this one is a similar bill that has to deal with 9/11. And it's just deleting obsolete language in there, referring to the Metropolitan Radio Board, which we have changed over to the Statewide Radio Board. I do have an amendment on this bill, and I guess I'd move the amendment first, and it's H3529A1.
Okay, that's been moved. Do you want to address that amendment?
It basically is just, again, clarifying the language, and it's getting rid of obsolete language.
All right, any questions on the amendment? Let's deal with the amendment A1. Those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The bill is amended. Any additional questions on this bill from the committee? Anyone in the audience wanting to be heard on this bill before us, please raise your hand now. Nobody has. If there's no other questions, the chair will lay the bill on the table for possible inclusion in our omnibus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Atkins. House File 1318, Criminalize False or Deceptive Email Advertising. Do I have a motion on the bill? Representative Kamar moves the bill for possible then inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's good to be back. I'm not worried about re-election with respect to this bill because I got this anti-spam bill. I'm not worried about it either because I got an email just a couple days ago. I found out my Uncle Willie who I didn't even know existed. He died. He was in South Africa. Left me $30 million. All I had to do, I set my bank account number and my Social Security number, and I'm good to go. So you won't have me to kick around much longer. But that said, this bill is the anti-spam bill. What it does, when Congress passed the Can-Spam Act in 2003, they carved out a separate area where they invited states to pass their own legislation allowing for state enforcement with respect to spam. And we're not, you know, we're not looking at somebody who's sending out five emails to the PTSA list. These are folks that are sending out thousands or hundreds of thousands or millions of emails, impersonating others. They take over other people's email accounts. They churn. There's five various methods that the people use or that the spammers use. The reason why Minnesota has become a focus is because, and I might add, Minnesota, Virginia, Maryland, there's three or four other states that have passed their own state actions as well, is because, lo and behold, we happen to be home to the sixth largest spammer in the country, according to the industry. AOL initially put this bill forward. They no longer have much of a state presence, but it's still an important bill. They confirm that the spammer in question is still operating here in Minnesota. It is a, I would finish by just saying this is not a partisan bill. It's bipartisan. In fact, Representative Lippman, who's here, was the original author of the bill. It's supported by co-authors, including Chair Wilkin from the Commerce Committee, Representative Mullery, myself, Representative Powell, has progressed in the Senate, and I believe is on the General Register in the Senate. We actually ran out of time with respect to the bill in the House. It passed everywhere else unanimously, and evidently last year simply was not transferred from the Commerce Committee, where it passed unanimously, to here in time for it to be potentially included in the omnibus bill. With that, I would stand for questions or concerns that members may have.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, who's that largest spammer?
I am, you know, I don't know the name of them, Representative Murphy, Mr. Chair. I'm just told and had it confirmed by the AOL folks that they are, in fact, operating in Minnesota.
I think they write to me a lot.
Any other questions from the committee? Anyone in the audience wanting to be heard on this bill, please raise your hand. I believe, Representative Atkins, there is a fiscal note of $500,000 chargeable to the Attorney General. Is that right?
There is, Mr. Chair. I don't know if it's in your packets or not. They did emphasize in the fiscal note minimal impact on supervision caseloads, projected not to have an impact on state prison resources, and the number of new offenders convicted under the bill will be very small. Frankly, it's really in the hands of the Attorney General's office if they choose to pursue. This gives the Attorney General and the providers an opportunity to pursue claims against the spammers. If they forego that opportunity, there shouldn't be a whole lot of cost to it. But if they do decide to pursue that, then it would require some of the resources of the Attorney General's office.
Representative Atkins, we originally started this by suggesting that we could laid on our table for possible inclusion in our bill. Does this bill have to go to state government committee, finance committee?
My understanding is it has not been requested by anyone else. I visited, went to Commerce originally, came here. I'm not aware of anyone else that's asked to see it, but anyone else that does, I'd be happy to go there and chat with them.
Representative Atkins, it has not been requested by Chairman Seifert. I guess I was just going to see what, where you wanted to roll the dice, whether it was Seifert's committee or here. We're prepared to lay it on the table for possible inclusion.
Mr. Chair, I'd be perfectly comfortable. You have a pretty good track record with your bills, the omnibus bill passing, and I'd be more than comfortable with the bill being potentially included in the omnibus bill, but whatever you would advise, I would be more than comfortable with.
I was just asking a question, not for argument for possible inclusion, but you're doing quite nicely, Representative Newman. Did you have a question?
Is there a private cause of action in here for Representative Murphy?
Pull your mic up.
Not being facetious, is there a private cause of action?
Mr. Chair, Representative Newman, there is not. There is a private cause of action for the providers. They are the ones that tend to spend the resources necessary in order to go after the spammers. This would provide for the providers to have a private cause of action against the spammer. My point in the bill in not asking for the private cause of action on behalf of the individual is that in most cases the claims are so modest that it would make a great deal of sense to efficiently proceed with a suit against the spammer. But moreover, quite frankly, I was a little concerned about having anything that would trip the bill up. It's a good bill. It's the kind of bill that Congress invited to fill that gap that was carved out for the possibility of state action. I'm not guaranteeing that I won't be back with exactly that bill, and I may come and visit with you about it if you'd be interested in it. But this bill does not do that.
Thank you.
If there's no other questions, and with the author's permission, the chair will lay this bill on the table for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay.
I'm going to go to Representative Dabney, House File 1943. Are you here?
Yes, sir.
We're fighting time a little bit. We're willing to be flexible in not asking a whole lot of questions, I hope. So why don't you be brief as well? Hang on just 1 second, though.
Amendments. I'm not sure what got. I'm not sure what got.
I don't. That's all I have. I don't. Do you have an amendment? We're going to just be discussing it. Why don't you keep the only copy, and then we can have a copy later for inclusion in these packets. Thank you, Representative Dabney, for a little pre-presentation discussion. This bill is not in our committee. It would appear that due to circumstances beyond anybody's control in this room, the DE2 amendment that you had intended to present to us in hard copy is not with us. Of course, the bill is not either, but you've got the floor. Present the DE2 amendment and your bill, and for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just need to see if I can win the fight with the computer here briefly, and it's not clear that I will. There it is. Mr. Chair, thank you particularly for the opportunity to present this to you. It's no news to members of this committee that identity theft is a major topic of concern before this body and before our voters, has been for a number of years. House File 1943 is a comprehensive approach to dealing with the concerns of ID theft for consumers. I have developed, and will get to the chair and interested members, a delete all amendment that changes some of the more salient portions of the bill in an attempt to move the discussion along. There's a number of members who have bills that are in a constellation of concerns around identity theft, and there's some very good bipartisan conversations occurring. To get to the most salient points here, the DE2 amendment keeps in place the opportunity for all consumers to request of the credit reporting agencies that a freeze be placed on their credit reports. Now, this allows all consumers to do that. In California, this has been the law, if I recall correctly, for 3 years now. They've had a total of 11,000 consumers request a freeze on their report. So there's not been a stampede for this service, but there clearly is a need, particularly for ID theft victims. The DE2 amendment does allow victims of identity theft to have this freeze placed and withdrawn at a later date when they feel comfortable at no charge. It does allow the consumer reporting agencies to place a diminutive $5 fee on other consumers who wish to place a freeze. There's a recognition and there's discussion amongst members of the body that there is a cost associated with this to the credit reporting agencies. I think there's bipartisan sense that we do not want this to become a revenue source for the consumer reporting agencies. I can already find people who are willing to sell me my free credit report annually. This shouldn't become another revenue source, but a recognition that identity theft victims are in a particular circumstance in this area. I'd also caution members who may not be as familiar with some of these issues as members of other committees that whenever you look at a fee at a credit reporting agency, you have to triple it, because the consumer has to have it not put on just by Experian or just by TransUnion or just by Equifax, but by all three credit reporting agencies. And particularly if you're looking at an elderly individual on a limited income, you start multiplying by three and it gets to be a meaningful amount of money on a limited budget. The other salient issue here is how long does a credit reporting agency have to thaw a freeze. If a consumer has placed a freeze on their credit report, whether they're an identity theft victim or not, and now is in a position of looking to purchase a new car and needing financing, a home equity loan, in some way needing to access credit, how do they do that, and how long does the consumer reporting agency have to release that information to the party or parties that the consumer has identified they wish to have received that information? Currently, in a number of the states that have already passed security freeze language, if I recall correctly, in a majority of them, they give consumer reporting agencies 3 days to report out the contents of the consumer's credit report, scores, things of that nature. The trend appears to be going forward to instead collapse that time down to just 15 minutes. New Jersey has already passed that. My understanding is Utah has now also passed that in consultation with the credit reporting industry. So the industry is seeing a need to move in that direction of collapsing the amount of time needed, particularly as the DE2 amendment does, for those who are making the request for a thaw by electronic means. If you're doing it by letter, clearly you've got a longer timeline. If you're a business who's trying to establish credit, you're a car dealership, and you've done the deal on the car, you don't want that consumer to wait 3 days before they get their credit report released and before you're able to determine whether you can provide financing to them or not. You want it in a much tighter timeline. The DE2 amendments directs the consumer reporting agencies to develop procedures for getting it down to 15 minutes to create a thaw. That eliminates the tension that currently exists in some of these discussions between retail business and the consumers, and kind of unites the retailers and the consumers on the same page, providing the protections the consumer needs while also providing the access to credit that both the consumer and the business needs. Does this count against my time, Mr. Chairman?
I think we're going to recess at this time.